you know, we think that students are asking for cake, but they're asking for steak. And, you know, we so sometimes our student ministry is based on like fun and games and all that kind of stuff. These students, I mean, remember, I was 19 when I went on my missions trip and saw God use me to heal somebody. You know, are we treating these college students as full grown believers? Maybe not as mature. Are we treating them as people in which reside the same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead? If we believe that, then every student has the potential to not just receive ministry, but to do it. Our students have been imprisoned for sharing their faith.
Well, welcome to the Lausanne Movement podcast, where we have a passion to accelerate global mission together. I'm your host, Jason Watson, and today on the podcast, we have the privilege to introduce you to Richard Coleman, a cross-cultural minister with TMS Global. Richard and his family moved to Ethiopia from the United States to become part of a team that serves in one of the world's largest student ministries, reaching up to 50,000 students and leaders. During our time together, Richard shares what it's like to move his family from one country to another. He shared personal lessons he's learned in cross-cultural ministry and offers valuable insights into improving cross-cultural intelligence and leadership. And so, if you're keen in growing in your own ability to connect, build relationships, and lead others from other cultures, then this episode is for you. So, let's jump into my conversation with Richard Coleman.
Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's really great to be in Ethiopia with you, where you've been serving for many, many years with your family. Mm-hmm. In this interview, we're going to be unpacking that, unpacking your experience. But I want to just frame it for everyone. You've come from the United States as a missionary. Could you share with us how your mission journey began? You took a couple of trips with your university. Could you unpack that and how you got stirred by the Spirit of God to go to missions?
So early on in life, I was exposed to different cultures. You know, my mother worked at a university and she worked in the international student department. So when I was like first grade, I took some Arabic classes. Don't ask me to say anything, but I did take classes. And just being around different kinds of people always intrigued me. I liked the food, the languages, I liked the different ways of doing things. But I grew up in a 99.9% black community, solidly middle class black community in just outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and didn't have a lot of exposure to the outside world. And when I ended up getting this full scholarship to Morehouse College to study biology, I wanted to be an entomologist and study bugs. Don't ask me why. It was just, I loved terrorizing my sisters by chasing them with insects. And so I ended up dropping that full scholarship after the freshman year to go to Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in the midst of that transition, my mother had a dream that I should get my passport. So I did it, you know, and that very first year at ORU, when I was a sophomore, they had a missions chapel service. And they showed images from the previous missions trips, as well as gave the biblical mandate for mission. And I was super excited because as a black American, there's this interest in Africa. I want to go to Africa someday. And they had a number of Africa trips available and they assigned me to the Uganda trip. This is 1998. And that trip really changed my life. It was 7 weeks with a team of, I believe we were six people. And we had a chance to do real ministry. I was 19 years old. So you know my age now. Good math, if you have good math skills. And on that trip, God used me to heal somebody, cast out a demon, preach in front of prisoners, do things that I didn't think that I could do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew how to do academics, I knew how to do sports, but I didn't know how to, quote unquote, do ministry. And one event completely changed my life. Actually, two things. One, I was walking down the street in Uganda, and I just had this deep sense of peace. Like, I could do this. I could live here. And the second thing was, there was a woman who came up to me at the end of the service and wanted to, she said she was demon-possessed. And I thought to myself, well, that's too bad. What do you want me to do about that? And I prayed for her just to be polite, but I didn't anticipate anything would happen. And she came back to me a second time, and I went to the pastor. I said, would you help me? I don't know what to do. And he pointed at me, and he said, you cast it out in the name of Jesus. And that shaped my entire ministry. You know why? Because oftentimes believers want to outsource what the Holy Spirit can do through them to someone that they deem as more competent. And by him pushing it back on me, I had to depend on God myself. And that shaped the way that I do ministry. I try not to become the celebrity minister guy who everyone has to flock to. Say, no, wait, the same Spirit that raised Jesus from the dead lives inside of you. Let's pray together or let's do ministry together. So anyway, that's just a little bit of my story. I did a number of missions trips after that. joined the mission staff at ORU, and then became the missions director at a mega church in Atlanta. And then my wife and I had $90,000 in school debt, so we couldn't serve right away. Fast forward, after 3 years there, I served as a mobilizer for 11 years and really had a sense to go. And the end of the story is that one of my coworkers said, hey, we want to send people to major cities around the world that have significant Christian populations that haven't been sufficiently mobilized. And he went through a list of countries. And when he said Addis Ababa, I just said, I'm interested. And that was that. There was no tingly feeling. There was nothing magical. That's just how it happened.
It was just the next step in your journey.
It was the next step. And it made sense because I had grown a love for the continent of Africa. Mm-hmm. And I'd also had exposure to Ethiopian food over the years and almost dated somebody who was Ethiopian, but had never been there. I'd been to Kenya, Uganda, South Africa. I love South Africa, by the way.
It's a great country.
Oh, I love it. And before Ethiopia, you know, South Africa and Brazil were two of my favorite countries. They can still be my favorite, right?
They still can. And you can still come and you can minister in South Africa.
I would love that.
There's a lot of opportunity to serve.
You have a guest room?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
That would be great.
We pull our kids off their beds and that'll be your space.
Good. I'll do it.
Yeah. So you had this opportunity, an open door. I'd be interested, were you married at that stage? And how did your wife respond to that opportunity?
Yeah, so missions is actually what drew my wife and me together. Mm-hmm. We had some mutual friends who I knew from college, and they met her when they moved to Houston, Texas. She's from Spokane, Washington. So she moved from Spokane to Houston. They moved from Atlanta to Houston, and they became our young adult pastors. And they eventually said to her, you know, we think you'd be perfect for this guy we know named Richard Coleman. Because, so to give you some context, I'm a Black American, you know, at this conference, I'm telling everybody I'm a Black American. They're like, but you're not Black. I'm like, no, you have to understand. Like, there's for example, in South Africa, I'm colored, mm-hmm. you know, I would never say that in America. What? You call me colored? Right. But I'm a Black American. And so right now we just did a research project through Missiology Magazine, if I'm not mistaken. And we only were able to locate 179 African-American missionaries in the entire world. So I think that when you come across someone like me and you come across someone like my wife, you're like, there aren't many of you that are interested in these same kinds of things. Maybe you guys would be good for each other. And it turned out she's beautiful and smart and all the other things. And it just, you know, that just was extra. But it was the calling toward missions that drew us together. And we had hoped to do it a lot earlier. But as you know, school debt is a huge issue in America. Right before we moved to Addis Ababa, we were able to pay off the last amount of that $90,000. So we thank God for that. There was no miracle, just like lots of blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah. Little steps of faithfulness.
Right.
On your own side, right?
Right, right.
So tell us about Addis. Give us a picture of the city, the kind of ministry that you've now become involved in.
Yeah. So Addis Ababa, at the time we moved here, I think it had the fastest growing economy in the world, a number one airline in Africa, a home of the African Union, situated near countries like Somalia, Djibouti, Yemen, those kinds of countries that, you know, could use gospel witness, right? And when we moved here, some things are very different. You know, for example, we come from a place where there's a lot more green space for playing and that kind of stuff. But we've been able to find places since then. The prime minister has a passion for planting trees and that kind of stuff. So that's been exciting to see. Mm-hmm. Because anytime you live in a big city, you have similar issues. Space becomes very a hot commodity, and things like parks and that kind of stuff aren't there. Anyway, that's unrelated to us. So Addis Ababa is a big city with lots of people. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are moving here because they're seeking opportunities or that kind of stuff. But we like being here. There are a number of things about Addis Ababa that we love. I mean, they're probably countrywide. But for us, we love the way that people value relationships. So, for example, I don't have a car. I walk everywhere. And when I'm walking from point A to point B, I greet about 20 people. You know, and it's not just hi. It's like, how's your mother? How's your father? How are your kids? And then a second round, how's your mother? How's your father? How are your kids? And then maybe even a third time. And it feels special to be seen and to be acknowledged as a person. Where I'm from in the U.S., you know, time is money. So people don't slow down to engage or interact. And despite Addis Ababa being a big city, there still is that willingness to slow down and acknowledge people, also to slow down and eat. So I've been here for 5.5 years, and I've only seen, to the best of my knowledge, maybe less than 5 times someone walking and eating at the same time. As an American, I try to be efficient and eat while I'm working. So I'm typing with my left hand, eating my sandwich with the other, not by myself because I want to be productive. And here at my office in Addis, the staff says, no, it's lunchtime. Let's go eat. And we eat together. We eat off of the same plate and we laugh and we talk and we build friendship and relationship. And that spirit of Addis, or even the whole country, is something that has nourished my soul in ways that I really needed it. I could say so many things more about the city. I mean, again, it's a city, so it's busy, there's traffic, there's noise, there's smells, there are unsightly things. But at the end of the day, I love being here because it's just, I don't know, it's just like, it feels right. It feels like community.
And so you came from the States, you obviously had cross-cultural experience, but I would love to hear, as you transitioned here 5 years ago, I am certain that you've made some culturally inappropriate
one or two
moments. You've had some moments. Could you share some of that with us and the lessons you learned?
So we moved here in our very first year. The only focus was learning language, learning culture, building relationships, and growing spiritually. There was no other agenda. We were not forced to work. Our agency had that as our responsibility.
Awesome.
And that allowed us to avoid a lot of mistakes. Doesn't mean I haven't made any. But it does mean that because we were slowing down, we had a chance to see what people were like and to get to know their world in ways that other missionaries hadn't. I use the word missionary, you know, kind of hesitantly because sometimes it carries a lot of baggage. But anyway, I make mistakes, but not as often because I kind of anticipate what people do and know not to do those things. Mm-hmm. I did, however, make a mistake the other day. This was like 2 days ago, a fresh mistake.
Share it with us.
Yeah, so we were renting for the L4 AM conference a cajon, you know, one of the drums that you sit on and play. And the guy who was arranging the rental didn't know the guy he was renting from. And so the guy who we're renting it from said, hey, I need to be paid the full price before I send you my drum. And I said, look, dude, this is a 300 person event. Like, I'm going to pay you. Like, this is not, I have so much going on right now. Just send me the drum and I promise I'll pay you. And he's like, no, I've been burned before. I can't take that chance. And I said, man, this is a Ferengi conference, meaning like foreigners. I said, you know, this is not Ethiopian. We're going to pay you. And the friend who arranged this corrected me and said, you know, and I'm actually offended that you said that because you implied that foreigners are honest and pay and that Ethiopians don't. And I was like, yeah, you're right. That was wrong. I shouldn't have said that. Because I know lots of foreigners that, that are shady. And so I apologized. And I actually sent a text to the guy who I'd made the comment to. And he forgave me. Now, what I do know, it makes sense to me. Because Ethiopians, and anytime you say Ethiopians, I mean, there's 83 languages or more spoken here. But generally speaking, Ethiopians are very proud people. They've never been colonized. They don't feel little around other cultures. They see a person from Europe or wherever, and they don't feel intimidated. Mm. They're like, we're Ethiopians, right? We're proud. So when people try to say things that are disrespectful or things that insinuate that Ethiopians are bad or criminals or anything like that, they take it very personally and will be among the first to speak up and to say, I didn't like that. So I appreciated him saying that. And I very rarely do things like that, but I did it this time. And I tried to make it right, you know? So hopefully God will take that and use it as a witness to the guy that I texted and said, look, this guy apologized to me. That doesn't happen a whole lot.
Yeah. I'd love to hear how the Ethiopian church and your experience with Christians here in Ethiopia shaped your faith and shaped your life and even shaped the way that you do mission.
I try to highlight the positives of Ethiopia without bashing America. I mean, it's very easy to bash America. I mean, who can't bash America? That's easy, right? But I think being here, there's a desire for holiness. Whether people do that well or not is not the question, but people desire to be holy before God. For some people, that means setting up a lot of rules, almost like the admonition that Paul gave against the Galatians. He's like, look, you've been set free. Don't put yourself in bondage again. It's just not worth it. And in some of my encounters with Protestants here, in an attempt to be holy, in an attempt to be set apart, I think sometimes they've missed on opportunities to be contextual in their witness. What do I mean by that? You know, here there's no drinking whatsoever. That's common across Africa. It's not really a big deal, but people would be quick to label that as a sin. Dancing. So maybe there's a cultural dance that in and of itself is just a cultural dance, but many people will shun it or avoid it. Secular music of any kind is forbidden because of a translation in the Bible, Galatians chapter 5. They translate one of the words as secular music. So the Ethiopian church has shaped my faith in that it has allowed me to say, okay, as an American, I want to try to correct stuff. Say, wait, your understanding is limited. Let me help expand you and help you understand. But in doing so, it almost feels like you fight against the intention of the rule. The intention is to be holy, to be set apart. And as an American, I'm like talking about freedom. And when those things kind of clash, you just feel like, how helpful was that really? Mm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
And so I find myself trying to exercise the freedom I have in Christ, while at the same time not creating stumbling blocks for people who are trying to remain faithful to the best of their knowledge or their understanding of scripture. Mm. The other way Ethiopian faith has impacted me is another thing that shaped my faith here in Ethiopia has been something that challenges my cerebral approach to the scriptures or to the faith. Many times in America, we focus so much on having correct doctrine or focusing on the right teaching, so to speak, that our faith is up in our head. And it really does help to be around Ethiopian believers who express their faith so colorfully through worship, through fasting, through prayer. For example, the ministry I work with, every single Wednesday is a fasting day, you know, up until noontime where we all pray together. It's taken seriously. And it really pushes me to remember that just having correct thinking is not enough. We're supposed to engage God with all of our heart, our soul, our mind, and our strength. And definitely here, I see heart engaged in such a beautiful way.
That's beautiful. When you go back to the States, what is the most shocking thing that you experience? You know, when you've immersed yourself in another culture and another faith system, and you go back to where you've come from and what you grew up in, what shocks you and what do you wish the American church could hear?
Yeah. I'm fascinated how lonely people are in America. Wow. You know, like you would assume that having things, going to fun events, basketball games, amusement parks, you would assume that those things would make people satisfied. But there's such a deep loneliness. And when I'm in the States, I just say, man, I hop in a car and I go to point from point A to point B. I get out of the car and I do what I need to do and I go back. You know, it feels like it's just lonely. It's sad. It's depressing. I don't think I've ever heard anybody here say they were lonely. I'm sure there are lonely people in Ethiopia, but I don't hear people say they're lonely because there's always someone there. You probably want your alone time, you know? But when I walk down the street, people see me. They're like, hey, Richard, good to see you. What are you doing? Mm. How's your family? Where are you going? You know, there's like this sense of interest in me. Mm. And that is very human. Mm. I think in America, we have in some ways stopped being human because we've become, I don't know, efficient. We've become robots.
Wow.
I mean, we don't think we're robots because we have so much choice. We have so much freedom, so many opportunities, so many things that we can decide to do on a Saturday or a Sunday. But at the core, we're just pretty sad. I love my country. I do. Mm-hmm. But I wish I could bring that Ethiopian sense of community over to America.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being vulnerable and sharing how your different cultures that you're experiencing are colliding with each other and unpacking that for us. I want us to talk about your ministry here.
Okay.
Because in my opinion, it's really exciting. And so could you just share with the audience what you are doing and the context you're working in and the people you're working with?
So before I answer that, when I was in high school, I was always involved in everything. I was like a jack of all trades, master of none. And that's kind of how I am here. My visa is through EVASU, the Evangelical Student Union of Ethiopia, which is the Ethiopian IFES affiliate. We're one of the largest in the world, if not the largest IFES movement with over 50,000 students.
Wow.
And so though my primary ministry is to EVASU, I love getting involved with other ministries and serving in whatever ways I can. For example, I have a friend who just started a ministry to help women who have been trafficked or abused. And just sitting with her and advising her on how to start the ministry and how to fund the ministry, or meeting with a friend who works in the trash dumps with families. Those are not my primary ministry, but I've always been a little bit scattered.
Yeah.
I discovered 5 months ago I have an adult ADHD. So now it's kind of like, I don't see it as a liability. I mean, it does have its struggles, but it also is like a fun thing to have, you know? Anyway, so what I do with EVASU is we have, again, 50,000 students. But we have regional directors and campus leaders who are serving those students. And we also have student leaders who serve their peers. My job is to help train these leaders and prepare them for what they're going to encounter. And it's not just traditional spiritual empowerment, not like just Bible teaching, though that is valuable. I also teach things like personality. We have some people who their personality is very strong, task-oriented. They get the job done, but they hurt people in the process. We have some who are so communal and laid back and friendly that they don't get the task done, right? So helping people to acknowledge who God has made them to be, how their environment has shaped them to be, and then help them to see the weaknesses and the strengths that come along with that. How do they work well with others? How do they work through their weaknesses? So I teach things like that. I teach just anything, really. Sometimes I get a phone call and say, hey, can you teach a class on Islam? I'm like, well, that's not my specialty, but sure, I'll do it. But the whole goal is to shape these leaders so that they can, in turn, shape and train their students. One of my favorite ways to do that is through experiential education. I love to do games and activities with balls and hoops and, you know, cones, just anything. It's a lot of fun. But that's one of my jobs. I also work with helping to find resources. We have an amazing staff. I'm not just saying that because I work with them, but the level of sacrifice that my teammates make is just amazing. And I don't want any of them to suffer because they have said yes to what God has called them to do. When I say suffer, I mean in terms financially. So if I have access to resources, I want to, in appropriate ways, be a bridge to make those resources available to my team. Because we have 105 staff. We used to only have like 70 when I joined, serving 50,000 students. I don't want anybody to have to leave the ministry because they don't have funds. And then the final thing I do is I work with our member care team or our staff care and development. We have those 105 students who are pouring out their lives, and there's such a tendency toward workaholism because you want to be there for the students in their downs, in their lows, in their highs. You want to preach. You want to go visit people. You want to do evangelism, and people get burned out. So how can we teach people good self-care? And then also, how can we provide care within the organization or even outside of the organization to serve our staff well? So I do those primary three things with Ivasu. And then the final thing I do is I just became a teacher at Bingham Academy, which is a private school, private Christian school here in Addis. And so I teach, I'm the middle and high school chaplain. And I'm also the 7th and 9th grade PSSHE teacher, which stands for Personal, Spiritual, Social, Health Education.
Wow.
So that's a lot of acronyms. Yeah, it is.
So, I mean, 50,000 students. Now, that's so little. I don't know what the Ethiopian church or campus ministries have to teach the world, but I mean, on a serious note, 50,000 students, that is insane. What is your organization doing to reach so many students? How do you engage them at that level where you have that much interest?
So a few years ago, InterVarsity USA sent some of their top leaders here to kind of see how was Ivasu able to do this. First of all, let's be clear, it's God that does this, right?
100%.
But there are a number of, what do you call it, like levels to the organization. Mm-hmm. Levels just for the sake of giving you a picture. So we have our students, and then working with our students are like their peers. Their peers will take on some kind of leadership role. They form families. So that family that you're with in your freshman year, you journey together through your entire 4 years of college, and you also are grouped based on your major. So you're all engineering students. You have a family. You do evangelism together. You pray together. You do other things together. There's also campus fellowship. So the families or the groups come together and have some kind of weekly fellowship. Those weekly fellowships take place in churches in the community because it's not allowed to have those kinds of things on campus. They try to separate church and state here.
Okay.
And so they fellowship there. Then we have, kind of above them, we have our campus staff. Those are the actual staff of Ivasu. Then above them is our regional directors who oversee the various regions that we have. And then over them, we have a student ministry officer. Then we have the student ministry director, and then we have our general secretary. So the structure allows us to have a small staff while at the same time taking care of all these students. And the beauty of it is that when these students each year come to our National Leadership Summit, our leaders come to that one, and they come and get equipped, they get inspired, and then they go back. And then they're the ones that are doing the ministry.
Mm.
And it's amazing to see the level of maturity, the level of dependence on God that they have. And so kudos to them, not to the people at the top, you know, for making this happen. But 50,000 students is challenging. We have a number of things that we're dealing with now. Ethiopia is going through a lot of things. You know, people are searching for identity. Who am I? Am I just Ethiopian or am I the tribe that I represent?
Mm.
And so there have been some things happen on campuses. And we have encouraged our people to take a peace-building approach, you know, not to take sides, but to find a way to be bridges. And it's a testimony to the ministry. In fact, some universities will look for our people to help to be the bridges or to help people during times of crisis to say, hey, can you find places for these students to stay now that this thing happened?
Wow.
So there's a lot of respect that we have. The highest levels of leadership in this country have people who have been through Ivasu or who are acquainted with Ivasu. And so it's really amazing to watch what God is doing. We project that we're going to be moving towards 70,000 students in a few years. There's just, the church is growing. The last I checked, Ethiopia was 44% Orthodox Christian, 34% Muslim, 19% Protestant. And the Protestant church is growing. I mean, we were called the Evangelical Student Union of Ethiopia, so we would fit that Protestant category. But anyway, it's just the church is growing. And that's nothing disrespectful against the Orthodox Church, especially because sometimes in this country, there's a little bit of shade that the Protestants throw to the Orthodox or vice versa. And what we try to do is just look, preach Christ and Him crucified and be bridges. So, yeah.
So I'm just reflecting back to my own context. I've been involved in student ministry, trying to reach students on the campus. What advice, what lessons do you believe ministers who are trying to minister to campus students could learn from the campus ministry that you guys have been working with?
So one of the things, I think someone gave this quote, and I forgive me, I don't know who said it, but they said, we think that students are asking for cake, but they're asking for steak. You know, so sometimes our student ministry is based on like fun and games and all that kind of stuff. These students, I mean, remember I was 19 when I went on my missions trip and saw God use me to heal somebody. You know, are we treating these college students as full grown believers? Maybe not as mature. Are we treating them as people in which reside the same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead? If we believe that, then every student has the potential to not just receive ministry, but to do it. And I think we expect too little from our students. Our students have been imprisoned for sharing their faith. There are certain parts of this country that are a bit antagonistic toward Protestant Christians. And again, I'm using Protestant because that's a category. And so they've been put in jail. I know someone who was leaving an area and they tried to douse the van with gasoline to kill them. These are students. And they count it as an honor to have, you know, shared their faith and then be persecuted. So I think that we expect too little from our students. Of course, they need shepherding. Mm-hmm. But Jesus sent his disciples out two by two, not shortly after he connected with them. What, I mean, you could argue maybe 2 years, 2.5 years, possibly. I mean, why not release these students to be salt and light?
Oh, it's so good. I think it's such a challenge for us to, I like that picture of cake and steak. Definitely going to take that with me. I really appreciate you sharing some reflections on the stories, but could you share a memorable story with us that might inspire those who are listening?
Yeah, so this is not really like a, you know, someone had no arm and they grew an arm back type story, but it's special to me. We have a leader who, he and his wife miscarried. They had twins. And they missed, you know, they lost the babies. And on top of that, he as a leader was going through some challenges, you know, like working through his personality and how it was impacting our other staff. So I have a habit of taking each one of my kids on a trip with me at least once a year. And this particular time it was with my daughter who was maybe 5 at the time. So I took her because I wanted her to be like a calming presence to the family who had lost this baby maybe a year before. But I just wanted her to have a role, if you will. Mm. So we get there, my daughter's playing with the mom and everything. They're having a good time. And with the husband, I said, hey, I want to give you a personality test. We're doing the DISC personality profile. Each staff member's doing it. Here are the letters D-I-S-C. D stands for dominant. He goes, that's what I am. I know I'm dominant. And I was like, of course, everybody knows that, right? So I had him take the test or the assessment. And almost exactly when he finished the assessment, it tested as D. Almost exactly when he finished, a wild warthog was running toward the playground while my daughter and some other children were playing. And he immediately dropped his pencil, jumps up, grabs a rock, and starts barking out instructions. You, get away from over there. You, do, you know. And he threw the rock at the warthog. And I'm still sitting there. My personality, I'm more of an S. I'm reflective. Oh, is that thing dangerous? Mm-hmm. Should I tell everybody to leave? I don't want to yell. That might scare them. Is this thing going to attack me if I throw a rock at it? So I'm still in my head. Yeah. And he's already acting out how his personality test had just showed him he would act out. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, I said, did you see this? You behaved exactly according to your personality. And I said, and it is a beautiful thing. Everybody looked at you. They respected you because you had a clear sense of what was happening. You protected us. I said, and that's the great thing about your personality. The difficult thing is sometimes in the process of doing that, you hurt people. And I want you to reflect over your leadership. You know, who might you have hurt because you didn't think about people's feelings in the process of accomplishing this task of reaching the lost and shepherding students? And he really thought about it. But it was funny to me how this incident happened when he dropped his pencil from taking the personality test. So yeah, that's one story that sticks out to me.
Thank you for sharing that. I want us to shift a little bit in our conversation and begin to speak about cross-cultural ministry.
Yes, yes.
Past 5 years, you've been doing just that. What lessons have you learned personally from cross-cultural ministry that you use when you are teaching others about doing something very similar to what you're doing?
One thing I have learned is this statement, all truth is God's truth. Like if an atheist teaches me about gravity, it doesn't mean gravity is not true.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, as believers, we definitely want to shield ourselves from bad things that could cause us to lose our faith, so to speak. But I think sometimes we become so closed off to other ways of thinking or other ways of doing things that we miss out on the beauty of what God has given to each culture. I've already shared about some of the things I've learned in Ethiopia, but they're just, I mean, you know, like dancing or just different things that you experience in other cultures. One of my favorite experiences, I was in Kenya and there were some guys who were Maasai, and I was in a meeting with them and they did praise and worship. And to have them jump in the air and land all together, boom, the floor shaking, boom, every time. And it's just the feeling of the floor vibrating. And I thought to myself, this is beautiful. They don't need Hillsong. Mm-hmm. They don't need Bethel. They don't need anything except what they have. It's beautiful. And mm-hmm. God honors it. And they're enjoying it. So I can enjoy it with them. And I think sometimes as cross-cultural workers, we judge inaccurately the beauty of things. And we don't take enough time to see if Jesus is there in the midst of that thing. So I enjoyed jumping up and down and landing, and I had a big smile on my face.
I'm sure you weren't able to jump as high as them.
No, not even close.
So
just to take a moment, a group from the United States come through to Ethiopia and you needed to cross-cultural training. What are some key lessons that you'll teach them?
Yeah, the first thing I do is, I mean, you live in Africa, so you know that people have this perception that people, they don't wear clothes. Their car's here? Wow, I didn't know that. You know,
there's a science.
Exactly. So there's this kind of condescension toward Africa. It's a dark place. It's a dirty place. It's a scary place. And I try to just humanize the place. Look, here's what Ethiopians are like. Here's how Ethiopians love children well. They protect me. You know, when something's about to go down, my neighbors let me know, hey, Richard, you probably shouldn't be in this area. Something's about to happen. Or they see my kids and they are protective of my kids. So I want them to see the strengths and the beauty before I talk about the problems. Because many times we lead with the problems. Say, oh, did you know that poverty is at this percent and joblessness is this percent? Did you know that this? And so we start with the negative and then we wonder why people have such a bad perception of Africa. So the first thing I try to do is show them the beauty of the culture. I want them to see how people dance. I want them to see or hear the beautiful music. I want them to taste the food. And I want them to, make it human. So the first thing I do is I try to do language lessons. I do like just maybe even just 1 hour. Here's some basic words. Salamno. They say, how are you? Is there peace? I'm going to say, ganando. Thank you. Right? And as they begin to engage language and culture, it makes Ethiopians people. And not, you know, these things you see on television with flies, but people. And then I think So I think I've said enough, but the point is they become human. They don't become Africans. They become Ethiopians and they become Mulukat. They become, Mulunesh. They become people.
So Richard, there's massive diaspora happening across the world. Every city is becoming more and more diverse as each day goes by. Let's say that there's a local church pastor in one of these global cities. And they're noticing that many different diverse groups are coming in. They're wanting to reach these people with the gospel. What advice would you give them?
Yeah, so my organization that sent me is called TMS Global. And we created a series called Who Is My Neighbor? And it was designed with that purpose in mind to help the average pastor to engage people who are different from you. And there are a number of things I could say, this whole series. But one of the things I think that is often not thought about is reciprocity. Mm. So what I mean by that is, the pastor says, oh, we want to reach XYZ people. We want to reach these Syrian refugees in our neighborhood. How can we serve them? How can we give them clothes and food and jobs? And the entire relationship is one direction. So people feel a sense of shame. Like, I have nothing to give. I don't feel human. So I would say, in your attempt to serve people, give them space to serve you back or to give back. The perfect story, I have a friend who lives in the U.S., and she told me a story of a church that was serving Iraqi refugees. And the church was wonderful, very kind, very generous, not no malice whatsoever. But eventually the Iraqi refugees said, we don't want anything to do with you. And it was over this issue. They felt like they were shamed because they had nothing. They were not asked for anything. They weren't given space to give. So I would say that, let's give, but also realize that we need to
put ourselves deliberately in receiving postures to receive.
Wow, that's so beautiful.
Yeah. We're going to bring this podcast recording to a close. Before we do that, how can people find you? How can people find more about the ministry that you're doing, find out more about campus ministry across the world? Are there any resources that you can point them to?
Yeah.
The website for the organization that sent me is tms-global.org. Stands for Train Mobilize Surge. I have a website, but I'm horrible at keeping up with it. It's called blackblessings.com. Black Blessings is from Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, where God told Abram, you're blessed to be a blessing, that kind of deal. And Black people are also included in that. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that, you know, I'm one of 179, and you can say 200, and you say 300. The point is there are very few African-American missionaries. And so just encouraging us to be blessings as well. So that's my website, blackblessings.com. And then the ministry I work with here, Evasu, EVASUE.net. But in terms of other ways to reach me, you can find me at some Lausanne things. If you Google my name in Lausanne, I've been a part of Lausanne since 2008. So I've had the privilege of being at almost every level of the organization except the paid staff. So I started out being a part of a North American advisory committee that led into Cape Town 2010. Then there was another gathering. I helped to plan the 2016 Younger Leaders Gathering in Jakarta. And then I was invited to be on the board as a younger leader for 2 years. And now at this L4AM conference, I've just been a gopher, you know, putting lots of miles in my Converse and just running around, just trying to serve the various needs of the community. So yeah, you can find me through Lausanne. But I'd love to interact with people that want to visit here. Even though I'm not Ethiopian, I feel like the last 5.5 years have taught me enough that I can represent Ethiopia well, fairly, honestly, and show people how beautiful this country is. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a lot of good things going on. Continue to pray for Ethiopia. I'd be lying if I said things were perfect here. So just pray for the country. It's a great country. Come visit.
Well, thanks for that invite. I actually hope that some of the audience will take you up on that, and maybe you'll have some people welcome you to us. Like,
Right.
Before we close, I just want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for the effort that you put in this gathering here, the Africa Middle East gathering. I've seen you running around doing all the work that you've done. But what I've so appreciated about watching you and the lesson that I've learned from you is you've done everything with a smile on your face. And I've noticed how you stop and you speak to the people. And this gathering hasn't just been a project that you've managed and been a part of. Notice the people. And so I want to recognize you for that.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah.
So yeah, thank you for your time. This has been such a rich conversation. And I'm trusting that in the next couple of years, you will have like 70,000 students.
Oh, yes. So I say to you, Xavier Barque, God bless you. And thanks for having me.
Thank you. Blessings to you as well.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Lausanne Movement Podcast. If you like this episode, why don't you take a moment to give us a rating and review and give us a shout out on social media. Next week, we'll be back with another episode that we hope will inspire you to accelerate global mission within your own space. Until next week, cheers.